Welcome to the Lady Up America podcast. I'm Diane Canada, your host. I'm so glad you're here today. Thanks for tuning in. Ladies, it is Tuesday. It is April the 9th, and we are continuing our series today, How to Grade the American President. Be right back. All right. So we know there are polls out there that are what I call the snapshots in time. They're catching people on the phone in the evenings just before or after dinner. And they're saying, hey, where are you at with, you know, with politics today? Who are you leaning toward? Who do you like? What are you frustrated about? What issues, you know, are plaguing your mind tonight? What's keeping you up at night? Asking a lot of voters around the country kind of how they feel today. And the reason I call them snapshots in time is because it's really based on emotion, these polls. You know, tomorrow something could change and they would feel totally different. So I don't look at poll. I mean, obviously polls are important and they kind of give us that feel for where everybody's at. But I'm looking at this series a little deeper, like how do we actually grade the American president? This is not based on emotion. This is based on literally how is he doing when it comes to upholding the values of our country. We hear Biden throw around terms a lot, like what is the soul? We're fighting for the soul of our nation. And again, that evokes an emotional response, but most people can't tell you what the soul of our nation is. And so what we've been doing lately is we've been going over what I call the seven founding values, the seven conservative values of our country, which you can get for free, by the way, right now, if you go to ladyupamerica.com and sign up for our e-list, then you can download these for free. You can also get them inside the Lady Up America app. But what we're doing is we're taking these seven values, which are the basis, the foundation for our Declaration of Independence, for our Constitution, for all of our founding documents. These seven values were what our founders really looked to uphold our republic. I call them the load-bearing walls of our republic. Every one of these can be found in all of our founding documents. And I found these from Speaker Mike Johnson's website. Now, he wasn't speaker when I found them. I found them about 3 years ago when I was first forming Lady Up America. And I came across them totally by accident when I was researching terms like rule of law and fiscal responsibility. I wanted to know where those terms came from, and this is what I happened upon. So I've been sharing with you in the last few episodes that these seven load-bearing walls absolutely simplify every breaking news topic that can come out tonight. It gives us a reference point. It gives us a true north on the compass of America, tells us what we stand for, what we actually believe in, all of these things that are interwoven into the fabric of our country. What is the soul of America? These seven values answer that in a very simplified way. So we've been breaking them down just one or two at a time each episode. And today we're going to finish that up. So I also want to remind you again, just in case this is the first one you're watching or listening to and you haven't caught the last ones, I want to remind you that as we are talking about these with friends and family, that you always want to refer to them as the load-bearing walls and not the founding values. Because to a lot of people who consider themselves to be progressive, when even though they are our founding values, if you say that, then it gives them an excuse to say, oh, you're antiquated, you're old-fashioned, you're trying to take us back in time to something old-fashioned, it doesn't apply in our modern society. So this just helps you get out ahead of that pushback. And you can reframe this and say, no, this is not a return to something old, but rather just like in HGTV, when you're going to tear a house down and remodel a historic home, you look for the load-bearing walls. You don't want to tear those down. Otherwise, the structure is unstable or the roof can cave in. So that's how we frame these. These are the load-bearing walls of our country. We need to take the hammer out of the hands of people trying to knock them down so that our republic doesn't crumble. So that's how I always frame these. So we've already gone over limited government and individual freedom. I highly encourage you to go back and listen to those. We went over rule of law and peace through strength in our part two. And then in our part three yesterday, we did human dignity. And today we're going to finish up with fiscal responsibility and free markets. So let's dive right in. Fiscal responsibility, according to Speaker Johnson's website, is defined in this way. Congress has a moral and a constitutional duty to be good stewards of our money, to resolve the current debt crisis, bring spending under control, balance the federal budget, reform and modernize entitlement programs, eliminate fraud, waste, and abuse, pursue continued pro-growth tax reforms and permanent tax reductions, and restore regular order and accountability in the budget and the appropriations process. Okay, that's a tall order for Congress. So for those of you who may not know, some of you know, I don't mean to insult your intelligence, but if you were like me before you got into before I got into politics, I didn't really understand enough about how the different branches of government operated. Congress, meaning your U.S. representatives, and that can also be at the state level, but certainly at the federal level. Our representatives hold the purse strings. They are responsible for basically all the budgeting of the taxpayer dollars. They're responsible for putting out a balanced budget. They're also responsible for a lot of these omnibus bills that keep getting passed when it's time to fund the government again each year. So they are the ones who basically control the money. Now, the senators have a different role. Okay, so, but the senator, the U.S. Senate is typically not the ones that are involved in how the money gets spent. They weigh in on it. Of course, there's a whole process for that, but the U.S. representatives are the ones that control the money. All right, so let's break this one down a little bit because there's a lot here and we don't want to miss anything. So Congress has a moral and a constitutional duty to be good stewards of our money. Now, it's important that the word moral is in there, right? Think about what that means for a minute. They have a moral responsibility to be good stewards of our money. So if they're not guided, we talked about this in another podcast episode, but if they're not guided by that moral clarity, then they're going to fall prey to things like bribery, right? Or things like greed. So that moral compass needs to be there even when we're talking about the money, and especially when we're talking about where our money goes. So I want to keep that in mind. Constitutional duty to be good stewards of our money. Obviously, the U.S. Constitution, when we elect representatives, because we are a democratic republic, we are not a true democracy here in America. We are a democratic republic. So each state, depending on the numbers in that state, depending on how many people live in that state, they have what we call electors. And then the electors basically go to the poll, or they basically take all of the votes that we cast as American citizens, and then they use those then to elect our representatives. So our representatives go to Congress basically to be held accountable by us. Now, when they get there, their job is to make sure that not only the state of Tennessee, like in my case, the state of Tennessee, is funded and well taken care of. They're there to advocate for us, but they're also there to advocate on behalf of the American people, but they answer to their constituent at home. We're not a true democracy because our founding fathers knew how dangerous that could be. If it was just based on popular vote, if it was just based on numbers of people voting and not done in the way that we have it done, where we have electors that vote on behalf, considering the volume of a state, they basically want the votes to be fair, right? So if we had a true democracy, one of the ways that I always frame that is it's like two wolves and a sheep having a conversation and about to vote on what's for dinner. Okay. So obviously, if you have two wolves and a sheep, then guess who's dinner? That sheep's going to be dinner. All right. So that's what that's the danger of a real democracy. A democratic republic is a much more fair and much more manageable way to govern. Okay. So they have a constitutional duty to their constituents back at home, but then they are also there to represent America in the Constitution. Okay. Another part of their responsibility is to resolve the debt crisis, bring spending under control, and balance the federal budget. I don't know when our budget in America was last balanced. I mean, we have, obviously, we have trillions of dollars coming in to the federal government, but we have way overspent our money in America. We are trillions and trillions in debt. So you'll hear things thrown around like GDP, gross domestic product. And basically, it's looking at what we produce, what we sell out of America. Maybe it's also referring to how much credit we've extended other countries. There's a lot of factors that play in. But at the end of the day, we've borrowed more than we make or sell. And so that, what does God say in the Bible? The borrower becomes slave to the lender. And unfortunately for us, China holds a lot of our debt. And so that's a very vulnerable place to leave America. Okay, and they certainly haven't reined it in. I mean, they continue to put out huge bills. They can continue to approve huge bills that just attach more and more and more money going out, more than we have coming in or that we're making. All right. There, another part of this is they are supposed to reform and to modernize entitlement programs. Okay. So entitlement programs, a lot of these programs that maybe initially were set up to help, they end up being a huge drain on the government. Because when you are giving a check to people and you're not really encouraging them to succeed in life or to get up and work and earn things, when there's just entitlements going out. And entitlements can look like all kinds of different things, but let's just talk about for a minute welfare. Okay, we look at the generational welfare that we see out there. We just have this, it was meant initially to be a help for people to get up on their feet and to go out and be productive members of society. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people that end up on programs like these just get lazy. Their check comes every week. And they're fine with that, and they are willing to live in sometimes appalling conditions and all of that, rather than get up and make something of their life. And so something that maybe initially was set up to help has now ended up hurting. We see generation after generation, you know, staying on government assistance, and that's not what it's designed for. They're supposed to eliminate fraud, waste, and abuse. Well, obviously, I mean, that we could do a whole show on that. That is very out of control. I mean, the waste, the fraud and the waste alone are staggering. And then we see all kinds of, when we talk about the abuse, we see all kinds of pet projects, you know, or things that are called, you know, one, I mean, like for instance, you know, studying the, you know, the mating habits of some species that we've never heard of, you know, pouring millions of dollars into that. I don't think for a second that they're really pouring money into that. I think somehow that's getting funneled. I don't know. But it just seems to me that there's a lot of waste and a lot of fraud, a lot of places for things to hide, things to kind of get put underneath, you know, code names or faux names, and then for there to be a lot of opportunity for abuse there. They're supposed to pursue continued pro-growth tax reforms, permanent tax reductions, and restore regular order and accountability in the budget and the appropriations process. I mean, that we see taxes doing nothing but going up. We don't see them coming down under this administration, certainly. And pro-growth tax reforms mean, so here's kind of the way I understand this. I was in business for a lot of years before, business and songwriting were my two parallel careers before I came into politics. And I am not a business expert by any stretch when it comes to financial. I mean, when it comes to the investments and things like that, that's not my area. So I don't pretend to be a pro, but I know enough to know this, that if you are constantly regulating and taxing businesses, then it really restrains their ability It puts handcuffs on them in a lot of ways in their ability then to trickle down benefits and good pay and all of these things to their employees. You have, especially in major corporations where there are shareholders and things like that. Am I going to sit here and say that there's not greed in those situations? Of course. And am I going to say that the profit margins aren't huge in a lot of these corporations? Yes, of course they are. But when you start tightening that, when you start taxing and regulating companies to the point where they're no longer making enough of a profit for it to be even worth having the business or worth running it, they're going to start cutting back in other areas. So, you know, when you do things like, you know, raise the minimum wage, or you do things like demand, you know, certain tax changes and all that, when it's felt up here, they're going to find a way to trickle that down and under their employees. And their employees are going to feel it. So they're not going to be able to offer as much. They're not going to be able to do as much as they would like to do maybe for their employees because they're feeling the squeeze up here. So when I hear Bernie Sanders and people like that saying they need to, you know, pay their fair share and all this, there's a lot more to that than what it seems, a whole lot more. So we can't be so naive to think it's just that simple. There's a lot of different ways that organizations and companies, corporations make money. And there's a lot of ways that they are able then to provide things for the people who work for them. And when it's squeezed at the top, you know, even just a little, then the people on the bottom are going to feel it the most. So it's just a very naive way to look at business. And again, I'm not a tax expert, but I just know enough to know that. Okay, so what happens when fiscal responsibility breaks down? Like I've just kind of been sharing, they're not good stewards of our money. We have a lot of debt that piles up. Do we see that under this administration? Absolutely, yes. Do we see spending that's out of control? Absolutely, yes. Do we see entitlement programs, fraud, and waste that are just exorbitant? Yes, we do see that. Do we see tax reductions or tax increases? I'm seeing a lot of tax increases. And do we have accountability and order in the budget and the appropriations process? No. And, you know, I can tell you, there are a lot of administrations that have gotten this wrong. It's not just this current one that we're in. But I can tell you, this is the worst inflation and the worst, in my opinion, this is the worst presidency we have ever had when it comes to the economy. I mean, it has really, really hurt the American people. They keep wanting to blame it on COVID. They keep wanting to say, oh, this is all residual from COVID and we're still trying to get on our feet. No, y'all, this is not. We had the best economy we've ever had under Trump. Did COVID wreak some havoc? Yes. Did we get a first round of those checks that went out when the country was locked down? Yes. And that did contribute to our debt. Absolutely. But here's the thing. We had ways to course correct that. When we were drilling heavily, when we were energy independent, we were billing, other companies had to pay us for energy. Or we had all kinds of countries paying their fair share and NATO and all these kinds of things. We had a lot more money coming in. So we had our GDP up, but then we had a lot of jobs that were still here in America. We also had a lot of money coming in from other countries. Well, when Biden took office, that stopped. Y'all, that stopped. So the money's just been, the economic crisis has just been increasing without that influx of money that we were getting from other sources. So you have to look at this from both sides, guys. I mean, yes, COVID put a hurting on us, but we had an ability to course correct. When this administration came in and they shut, basically out of spite, they shut down so many things that Trump did that were making us and bringing us in money. And then they started spending more. Just look at Ukraine. I mean, we have been putting out billions, if not trillions of dollars to Ukraine. I mean, there's so much money going out and we don't have the money coming in your own budget. If you just look at that, that is not sustainable. Okay. So I would give the presidency, the current administration, a big fat F on fiscal responsibility, 100%. All right. So let's look closer at free markets now. Free markets. The free enterprise system rewards hard work and self-sacrifice. and is the basis and the genius of the American economy. The government often stands as the greatest obstacle to the progress and prosperity of free people. Free markets and free trade agreements allow for innovation, improvement, and economic expansion, as risk takers are given the liberty to pursue the American dream and create more jobs and upward mobility for more people. All right, let's break this apart a little bit. So we reward hard work and self-sacrifice here. Y'all have been an entrepreneur most of my life. A lot of the women that are close friends of mine are entrepreneurs or in the financial space, a lot of them in the real estate space. So they deal with entrepreneurs all the time. I can tell you that when you start a business, when you take a risk and you embark on a new business venture, it is an incredible amount of self-sacrifice, an incredible amount of risk, and most definitely hard work. You work harder than you ever did at a job when you open a business. And there has to be a pathway to reward for that. Otherwise, people lose their initiative to want to do it. So you put in all this blood, sweat, and tears. You build something from the ground up, something you're proud of, that you've sacrificed. I mean, you've really just put everything, your whole heart into it. You open this business. That should be rewarded. There is nothing wrong with that. That's what has built America. That's what the innovative spirit and the creative spirit and the resourceful spirit. That's what we're all about here in America. We have led the world for centuries in our innovation. It's because we are free to create. We are free to reach the potential, our God-given potential. So that's a very, very important thing that we maintain here in America. The government stands as the greatest obstacle to the progress and prosperity of free people. That is so true. If the government is choking you off, like with regulations and taxes, like what we were just talking about, it makes it very, very difficult to succeed. Free markets and free trade agreements allow for innovation. We just talked about that, improvement and economic expansion, as risk takers are given the liberty to pursue the American dream and create more jobs and upward mobility for more people. So if you are rewarded, if you're able to really get out there and put your ideas into the marketplace and see, and it's really based on supply and demand. If people like it, enough people are interested in it, they're going to buy it, they're going to support it, then that's how we kind of know that we let the market dictate what succeeds and what doesn't. And when you're able to put out your idea and really pursue that and you actually succeed, then you create a whole bunch of great things with you. Like a lot of other people succeed alongside of you. Vendors that you work with, banks and finance companies that you work with, certainly employees that you're able to now put on your payroll. You're able to create jobs. I mean, there is just an amazing thing that follows free markets, capitalism. And right now we've got so many people that are just, you know, demonizing capitalism. Greed and capitalism are not the same things. Okay. Do people get greedy? Are there going to be bad eggs out there? Yes, of course there are. In anything, there are going to be bad eggs. But the norm, when we look at what we've been able to achieve and what we've been able to then verberate throughout the world, as America was first set up as a country, when we look at all the good we've been able to do, it far outweighs those bad eggs. It far outweighs the bad. It's all what you're going to choose to focus on. But free markets, when they start to break down, and another thing I'll say too, when you think about free markets, the takeaway from this, I always say, is that if you can walk into a produce store, we talk about competition, right? We want to talk about supply and demand and all these things. If you can walk into a grocery store in the middle of New York, in the winter, in the snow, and you can go to the produce section and you've got all kinds of choices. You've got just all the colors of the rainbow there that you can choose from for produce. If that is something you have access to, that is a result of free markets. When we have socialized markets, when we have a socialist government, then the shelves are cleaned out. There's hardly anything to buy. There's this woman, Daniela, that I had a podcast interview with a couple of years ago, and you can find it if you look back through my podcast library. She grew up in Marxist Romania, And she shares with me how she would go to the grocery store with her grandfather, and they would stand in line for hours and hours, and they would only be about halfway back. And by the time, and they had vouchers, you know, the government had given them vouchers where they could go in and get their weekly allotment, whatever. And she said they would always try to get there early, but there were a lot of times when there were already people in line ahead of them. So by the time it was their turn to go into the store and shop, she said the shelves were just cleaned out. There was nothing left to buy.
I've decided to let you hear from Daniela yourself. I'm going to insert a clip from my podcast interview with her.
Yes, we have ration. Everything was rationalized at that time. The government will decide for you how many you have. You're allowed 2 liters of milk per week. Oil, you know, to cook with the oil. There was like maybe a half liter of oil per week. You have a little card, a punch card, and you will go to the grocery store, who they were always empty. So there was nothing in there to buy. Kind of like Costco after, you know, coronavirus hit, like empty shelves. So people, you know, even if you have money to buy, there would be nothing to buy. So I remember as a child, my grandpa, or my grandfather will take me at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we will see the line up to 12 hours to get like a small little piece of cheese. There'll be a half pound of cheese or a pound of cheese for two people that they see. Cause you know, it's always portions. You couldn't, you know, so they would try to, you know, to spread it to as much as possible to as many people as possible. You'll sit hours to get a chicken, something that American people will never even comprehend what actually not having food to eat is. It's not because people, they didn't have the money, they couldn't afford it. It's just there was nowhere there because it was controlled by the government. Everything was controlled by the government. How much you eat, how much you, you know, you are allowed to owe. You can't, you know, how much, where you going, what you doing, everything was controlled by the government. You couldn't talk, you couldn't travel, you couldn't, you know, it's just, yes. So everything was rationalized to answer your question as it is.
That's what you get in socialism, Marxism. Those two words are one and the same. Socialism and Marxism are interchangeable. So people think they want socialism. They have no idea what the giant that they're awakening. They have no idea by inflating government and turning it into a giant among us. They have no idea what they're bringing down on them. It all sounds great to think about everybody having the same and everybody sharing and all of that. That is not reality. People are motivated by, if they can put in hard work and they can be motivated by money, by reward, whatever it is, that's how we are designed as human beings. And so if you've got somebody who's out there busting their bum to create something only for other people to come along and just take it from them, it's not going to be very long before they're not motivated to bust their bum anymore. It's common sense. Okay. So I always ask, you know, people, young people, I say, let's say that you go to work and you get your paycheck. You've worked all week long and you finally got your Friday paycheck. And as soon as you get it cashed, then you've got people that you don't even know lining up, taking a dollar and another dollar and another dollar. And before you know it, you've given out all your money to all these people and you get your dollar. You know, you wouldn't be very interested in socialism after that, you know, because these people didn't work for it and you did. They're just standing in line wanting their hand out. It's not, I wish that human beings were more, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I wish it wasn't that way, but it just is. You're always going to have some people who are willing to put in the blood, sweat, and tears, and other people who are more than happy to sit back and collect the fruits from the people who did. They're not willing to put in those blood, sweat, and tears, but they'll be happy to take the money from those who did. And we just can't have, it's just not, our republic will crumble if free markets come down. You've got to have incentive, and incentive is not a bad word. Okay, it's just not. So if we look at free markets, let's look at what's breaking down here. So if we're not rewarding hard work and self-sacrifice, then what are we rewarding? We're rewarding this idea of equity, where people can just step step up and take from other people who have worked hard and sacrificed. Are we seeing that in our country right now? Yeah. I mean, even just look at student loans. This idea of forgiving student loans, I'm not saying that student loans aren't astronomically high, and that is as a result of government getting involved, by the way, in tuition, subsidizing college universities. Okay, there's a whole thing going on there of why these tuitions have gone through the ceiling. Let's not even get into that. But if we look at somebody who has gone to college, they now have a degree where they can graduate and hopefully make a good living for themselves. And then the government comes in and they say, you know what, all that debt that you just took on to get that degree, we're just going to cancel it. Well, there's no such thing as canceling it because that debt still has to be paid to the college. And so who's going to pay it? Maybe the plumber or the electrician who didn't go to college. That's going to trickle down and get distributed somewhere. So it's not right that someone gets to benefit from going to college, getting a degree and all that, and then not having to pay the piper. It's just not right. To create more jobs and upward mobility for more people. Again, we're just not seeing that. If it's very difficult for an employer, like I said before, to be able to afford to hire people because of regulations or because of this increased minimum wage that they can no longer afford now. You think about it. As an employer, when you hire someone, you're not just paying them the hourly wage or the salary that you agreed to pay them. There are also payroll taxes on top of that. You've got to match Social Security. You know, there are benefits maybe that you're going to offer that person. And then if that person leaves and another person comes in and you've got to train them, now there's time you've lost between the transition, you know, other people that are having to now retrain and with turnover, things like that. There's a lot to that an employer has to consider. And so when you make it so that they cannot afford the minimum wage, then again, it means that less people are going to get hired. It means more work is going to get put on fewer people, and they're going to be stressed out and burn out because the employer can't afford to hire enough people to cover the workload properly. They're going to have to put more work on the few people that they can afford to keep. It's just stupid. It's just common sense, you know, and minimum wage jobs should not be seen as, you know, a place to camp. Let me just say that. A minimum wage job is typically either a young person in school and they're trying to work and earn an income while they're going to school, or maybe it's an entry level position with sights on doing better and going into a better job. A lot of times entry level jobs are second jobs. You know, but they're not meant to be a living wage kind of job. They're an entry level minimum wage job. So when we're now all of a sudden categorizing those as a living wage, and we're saying anybody who's in a minimum wage job should be looking at that as a way to make a living and live and succeed in this world only on that job. It's unsustainable. Maybe you need to work two or three jobs. I did that for many, many, many years, you know, but one job should not, especially a minimum wage job, should not be one that's that's expected to help you thrive in America. So there's just so many things about that are so, so, so wrong. And again, it's rather than rewarding hard work and sacrifice, maybe having to pull two or three jobs if you have to pull yourself out of a bind or to work your way up the ladder, whatever it is. That's the American spirit right there. Not go into an entry level job and expect it to feed me and my whole family, you know, without me having to lift a finger to do much else. It's just not it's just not common sense. All right. So I hope you understand better about all of these seven founding values as we've been breaking them down the last few episodes. I hope that this gives you much more of your center when you're looking at news topics that hit. I hope that it'll help clear the fog and help you really focus in on where the true north is, for you to get your bearings and for you to no longer be confused. And when you hear someone say, "We're fighting for the soul of our nation," I hope you will think about these, and I hope you will think about these being the seven load-bearing walls of our country. We have to reinforce these. These have to be upheld if our republic is to be upheld. If any one of these comes down, our republic comes down. All right, let me pray for you. Father God, thank you so very, very much for giving our founding fathers the wisdom to set us up for success. Thank you for these lessons we've taken away, Lord. I ask that they penetrate the hearts and really are memorable in the hearts and the minds of these ladies listening. Lord, I hope that you'll give them clarity and wisdom that when they're approaching conversations, that now they have a new tool they can use to do it in a very, very effective way. We love you, Lord. We pray over our country. Father God, please turn us back to you as a nation and heal our land. And Father, let every one of these women be so influential for you. In Jesus' precious name, amen. All right. Amen, ladies. I will see you back here tomorrow. I hope you have an awesome evening. And remember, lady up. Lady up around this time. Lady up around this time. Victory.